Hey, I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR Digital Producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition Podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Peter Hirschfeld in for Jane Lindholm. Back in May, under the dark of night, workers in New Orleans took down a statue of Confederate President Jefferson Davis that had stood in the city for more than 100 years. At Princeton University, students unsuccessfully called on administrators to strip the name of Woodrow Wilson, an avowed segregationist, from its School of Public Policy. And right here in Vermont, there's been a call to remove the name of author Dorothy Canfield Fisher from a children's literature award because of her ties to a group that allegedly supported the eugenics movement in Vermont back in the 1920s. And 30s. Across the country, communities are reconsidering the appropriateness of statues, flags, memorials, and other honorifics as they reassess historical figures through the lens of modern social norms. Today, we're going to talk to two historians about the dynamics that are driving this process. Kenneth Davis is a historian and author of Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Don't Know Much About History, and a number of other books in his Don't Know Much About series. Jeffrey Potash is a longtime Vermont historian and co-author of Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Kenneth, there's a word that historians use for this practice of assessing historical figures through the lens of modern social norms. It's called presentism, and it seems like a good place to start today. What is presentism exactly?
Presentism is the idea that we can't simply judge people of another century by the standards and mores of the late 20th or early 21st century. And it's an interesting point. It's a valid point in many respects when you think about how people lived at a certain time when certain ideas were far more accepted. When it becomes an excuse for an issue like slavery, however, I think we're treading on very, very different territory, specifically when it comes to America's founding fathers, which I suspect is where this conversation might be heading.
We will no doubt be going there, Kenneth, and many other places as well. Jeffrey, is presentism a new concept for historians, or is this a practice that has persisted since humans have been cataloging history?
Well, I mean, we think in terms of history as serving two really discrete purposes. One is the practice of developing myths for civics instruction, telling us who preceded us and why we bear some responsibility to carry on their legacy. And yet, at the same time, we have to carve our own niche. And subsequently, we do have to look and reflect upon where and how errors or shortcomings in the past can be corrected in the future.
How is myth different from history? How is myth the same as history, and where do they overlap?
Oh, I wish you had given that question first to Ken. I'll speak briefly and let him basically correct me. I think mythology is an integral part of human nature. Events transpire, generations are there to witness, and then as those charismatic leaders disappear, we have to somehow encapsulate their experience in myth. We do it with religious figures. We do it with political figures. We tend to one-dimensionalize because it allows us to retain some memory of their import. Academic history, to which certainly I've committed my career, is really more engaged in the notion of balancing what we can know against what we think we know. And so it's always an ongoing active process to try and discover something more about what we didn't recognize in the past.
Kenneth, does Jeffrey have it about right there?
I think he's spot on. Having written a book called Don't Know Much About Mythology, I would say that there's a sense of the word mythology that means the sacred stories that we tell, and every religion, every faith, every system around the world throughout history has created those sacred stories. When we talk about the myths of history, I think we're sort of putting it in quotes and coming up with these idealized visions, much more in the sense of legends, like the legends of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree and that sort of thing. The problem is that seeps into the history books, especially children's school books. The cherry tree story, in fact, was written by a man named Parson Weems, who was not a parson and didn't really know George Washington, as a set of readers for children that was couching reading books in the morality, the mythical, legendary morality of George Washington. But that really stuck in both American history and tradition, and certainly in the media. It's the job of the historian, in part, to peel off the legend, the layers of legend that we throw up around people, because we need to, if we're going to really learn anything from history, which is the point after all, have an accurate depiction of history. The problem is that history books, and especially textbooks and school books, certainly of an earlier generation, are more about creating a picture of pride and patriotism than they are about creating actual fact-based history. And, of course, we grow up and we learn, and we're supposed to grow up and learn and have a new view of these people. But then you get into the territory of, well, you're just trying to tear our heroes down. Heroes are important in culture. Heroes are important in history. The problem is that we create perfect heroes out of imperfect people.
We're talking today about how today's societal norms should figure into our assessment of historical figures from the past. So I'm going to have you jump off, Jeffrey, from where Kenneth left us. How far can we go? How far should we go in judging history and its historical figures using today's standards?
Well, I think the issue is that we write history from the vantage point of trying to understand the relevance of the past to the present. And one of the things, certainly when I started in the 70s writing history, was I was challenging the convention of the 1950s, a bipolar world, the Cold War in which good confronted evil, and the story of American history in the texts was all about great white men who couldn't do any wrong. As a child of the 60s and 70s, I took issue with that, and I began to envisage that history could be more diverse and more inclusive, and as a consequence began to probe different methods with which to begin to recognize. My interest in Vermont derives to a large degree from the fact that you cannot tell the story of Vermont through the lens of Ethan Allen exclusively. It's interesting, but ultimately you're going to see there were an abundance of other founding fathers, and there is a continuation of challenges in Vermont today that very much parallel the challenges that have, people approached in the past. We can learn from those decisions that they made in the past, and ultimately that can inform where we're going. So, the academic says that we probably would do well, as Kenneth has done, exposing the mythology, recognizing that it serves a purpose, but at the same while continuing to ask better questions that will allow us to use history in a productive method for understanding the world of the present and the future.
Kenneth, maybe just kind of lay this whole issue bare with an example. Were our founding fathers bad people, for example, because they owned slaves? And is there a right answer to that question?
There is a right answer to that question. So it's a difficult answer, and it has many layers, like all of these questions. But first of all, we are at this moment of reckoning, and I think, when I first spoke, I said we'd end up at the Founding Fathers. But let's go back to your intro. We have taken down the Confederate flag in many places around the country. We have begun to remove statues of Confederate heroes, as they were seen for many, many years. Those are a little bit easier now in some respects because the country has come to a moment of reckoning to say, wait a minute, these guys were not only slaveholders, but they had betrayed the country. They weren't heroes. They were traitors to their oath of office. They were traitors to the idea of the United States of America. They were trying to kill fellow Americans in defense of slavery, in defense of the indefensible. And we can just really set aside the notion that the Civil War was about anything but slavery, because it was not. part of the complication of those guys is that during the 1950s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, as a reaction to the civil rights movement, that South Shall Rise Again, states' rights banner was hoisted really as a way to preserve segregation. So there are really two problems with that version of history. But if we're going to start talking about the guys who fought against America and defended slavery, we also have to talk about the slave owners who built the country. Obviously, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, three of our first five presidents, were slaveholders from Virginia. So was Monroe. Andrew Jackson was a slaveholder as well. So five of the first seven presidents were slaveholders, and they held the office for 40 of the first 48 years. The only presidents who were not slaveholders in that time were John Adams and his son, John Quincy Adams. So how do we balance out the scales of history? This isn't revisionism coming from liberal historians. These are questions being asked at Monticello and Montpelier and Mount Vernon. All three presidential homes currently have major surveys and studies going on about the relationships of these presidents to the people they enslaved. I just wrote a book about it called In the Shadow of Liberty, examining the lives of five people who were enslaved by these so-called great presidents. And it is a moment of reckoning, and we do have to balance the scales. How to do that appropriately is the real question.
Jeffrey, the question of how to do that appropriately is an incredibly pertinent one at this particular point in time. What value does removal of a statue, say, a flag from a state capitol, a mascot from a school name, have when it comes to this reckoning that Kenneth is talking about?
Yeah, I like a lot of what Kenneth says. I'll take issue at some level. There's always a danger for the people who've not thought at the level that he has and done the research that he has to oversimplify circumstance. When I teach history, I try and reconstruct context. And the remarkable thing about the Founding Fathers is they represented the elite, within a culture that was grounded in slavery. Huge numbers of people allowed this tiny percent of people to be the best educated and to be extraordinarily well-versed on everything from moral philosophy and science. Look at Jefferson. They were truly Renaissance characters, and the impact of their educations in the structuring of the country was extraordinary. So we need to balance, what was a fundamental evil against the recognition that, in fact, it generated some positive good. That notion of reconstructing a multifaceted past, it seems to me, is critically important. And the danger of trying to erase, we need a conversation on the Confederacy, because in the southern states in particular, there is this mythology and this glorification of inclusivity that simply needs to be challenged and corrected. Again, the piece that I think Ken and I would both agree upon is that history in America, contrary to what many today might say, has been the story of ever-growing inclusivity. The Founding Fathers constructed a nation within which relatively few white men could vote. Take a look at where we've gone. There is a direction. There is a trajectory. And my hope is that, we will continue to use history to reinforce that trajectory in asking questions about why not? Why can't we do something different?
We're talking today about how today's societal norm should affect our view of historical figures from the past. Listeners, how should we look at our past? Do the norms of today have relevance when looking at the accomplishments or actions of people who came before us? You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Bob is calling from Rutland. Bob, what do you have to add?
Yes, and say thank you. I'd like to ask your guest in regard to something local, which was down in Turner Falls, Mass, where I know they were trying to get the name changed because Captain William Turner led a massacre against Native women, children, and elderly down in that community, and he has his name on it, and I know they were trying to remove it, which we would hope, as you mentioned with presentism, that the values today would be the same, that you don't visit war, let's say, upon women and children. Thank you.
What do you say, Jeffrey?
It's a really excellent point. I'll just jump in on that. This is Kenneth Davis. I think that that raises the question, you know, as we began talking about Dorothy Canfield Fisher and her the allegations that she favored eugenics, and you pit that against questions of people involved in slavery as a massive crime against humanity, which is the only way to describe it, or the massacre of Native American men and women, and we can certainly go through our catalog of great Americans of the past, considered great Americans of the past, and find plenty of examples of that. Andrew Jackson, first and foremost. One of the reasons that he seemed to be on the verge of being relegated to the backside of the $20 bill, and that he's now been re-elevated in the current White House. So, you know, pendulums do swing. One point I think I want to make clear about this is when we talk about presentism and the founding fathers, there is this notion that they were men of their times, but it's very important to note that they had their own reservations about this. Washington, Jefferson, Madison, in particular of the three men I write about, had grown to see the contradiction between a nation conceived in liberty and one that was also born in chains. Washington wrote in 1787 that no one wished more for a plan of abolition than him. He did precious little to bring that about. Jefferson knew that what he had written about in the Declaration was contradicted by slavery. He had actually condemned slavery in his draft of the Declaration. Those words were removed by the Congress. He later said not only the Southerners who owned slaves, but the Northerners who were making a great deal of money transporting them. A reminder that more than 40 of the 56 signers were slaveholders. So that, to me, is the central issue in this conversation about the past. And when it comes to more local issues, I think it's somewhat a matter of degree. How egregious is this crime? Once upon a time, the most famous woman in America was Hannah Duston, who over in New Hampshire, who was made a legend in her own time and afterwards, the first woman in America to be honored with a statue because she had killed 12 Native Americans in their sleep, including children. They did build a statue to her featuring an axe in one hand and scalps in the other. That statue is probably not, does not have that scalp and axe any longer.
I'm Peter Hirschfeld, and this is Vermont Edition. As societal norms change, should that alter our feelings about historical figures and events of the past? And looking forward, how will our actions today be judged in the future? Those are a few of the questions we're discussing today. And joining us are Kenneth Davis, historian and author of Don't Know Much About History, and Jeffrey Potash, a longtime Vermont historian and the co-author of Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont. We've got Mish on the line from Plainfield. Hi, Mish.
Hello. I am a university professor and required to teach ethical reasoning in my courses. I want to make the point that there is nothing to apologize for in a critical examination of the behavior of people who were lauded as heroes. It's not something that we apologize for. We should be proud to apply critical thinking in light of changing ethical standards. Ethics are not absolute and uniform, they change over time. And I'll listen to the commentary on the radio. Have a great day. Good subject. Glad you're raising this issue.
I also want to bring in Maya from Virgins before we let Jeffrey have a stab at that one. Maya, you're a high school student, huh?
Yeah. I'm just recently learning about all this, so I haven't really had a time to put a formulated opinion. However, I think that we need to start recognizing that this is our history, no matter what viewpoint we take on it. It is negative. This mass murdering and slavery is obviously a negative thing, but we need to recognize it to move on. I think that if we don't learn from our history, we're doomed to repeat it.
Jeffrey,
two really interesting calls there from Mish and Maya talking about the way we perceive what came before us and how important that is in terms of how we make sense of the world. Talk about what you heard me saying there about this critical reexamination and the need for it.
Well, I'll speak to both, actually, and try and bring Ken's point in. You know, recognize that the purpose of doing history is in constantly returning to and reevaluating the quality of what we've thought about in the past. Much like ethics evolve over time, it's critical that we understand that there are schools of historical thought. We can look at Vermont history, for instance, and recognize that the first Vermont histories in the 1840s, the foundation of the Vermont Historical Society, was grounded in a period of tremendous upheaval. Our agricultural foundations were deteriorating. People were moving, and people were questioning whether, with the arrival of the Irish immigrants, whether Vermont was going to retain its Vermont identity. In many respects, the eugenics movement of the early 1900s, founded by Henry Perkins at UVM, was yet another attempt to sort of reevaluate in the context of continuing ongoing change. Who are we? And schools of history continue to evolve and try, as I say, to better analyze the past from the multifaceted recognition that it contains both, as with human nature, good aspects and aspects that are not as good. Our goal, ultimately, in understanding the past, and this is where we struggle as historians, because those who advocate that history solely be civics imply that we can't tell any stories about shortcomings. But how else do we understand the evolution and the challenges that confront us today if we don't recognize that we haven't fixed everything, that we still bear responsibility, whether it involves prejudices, racial prejudices, religious prejudices, whatever. We didn't resolve those in the past, and that's why they're still on our plate.
Kenneth, do different countries and cultures handle these kinds of dilemmas differently from each other? I'm thinking of Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa, and that looked a whole lot different than what happened post-Emancipation Proclamation in the United States. And is there an argument to be made that perhaps the United States as a country simply has not done a very adequate job of taking steps it needs to atone for the sins of the past?
It's a very good and important question, and certainly other countries have done better jobs. Many other countries have done much worse jobs. One can think of, you know, the fact that Chinese books do not mention Tiananmen Square. Not just school books, but no books are allowed to mention it. So we have countries all over the world that do very good jobs of using what Orwell would have called the memory hole. The United States, I think, certainly on the academic level, is going through a constant process of recognition, revision. I know that word has a profoundly dirty meaning to some people, but we need to revise our visions of the past. We learn new things all the time. Just 3 weeks ago, they found Sally Hemings's room, or what is thought to be Sally Hemings's room at Monticello, curiously enough, attached to Thomas Jefferson's bedroom, and that certainly changes our view of history. So we need to revise this. We also, I think, can look at, you mentioned South Africa. They did an extraordinary job with that moment of truth and reconciliation. Also, Germany has a very, very stringent and aggressive teaching of what happened in Germany in the 30s and 40s and the Holocaust. Different countries certainly have different approaches to this question. We in America still need, I've used the word reckoning before in this conversation, a lot of people think that slavery was a small piece of the American picture practiced in part, when it in fact was one of the central acts in our drama. The country was born with slavery written into the Constitution in the form of the Three-Fifths Compromise in particular, which gave the slaveholding states inordinate political power. It was the centerpiece of the economy. It made great wealth, North and South. And those were the reasons, the financial and political reasons, that slavery became such an issue. As a moral issue, it was, you know, the people who were looking at slavery morally, the abolitionists, were a kind of small fringe group, which is also gets to the question of ethics. Many Christians in America who would have considered themselves very ethical thought that slavery was biblically justified and also a good thing for the Africans because they were being brought out of their barbaric, heathen, dark continent. So even our view of what's ethical at a moment has to be adjusted in some ways.
Let's bring in Ndahe from Cabot. Ndahe, I hope I'm not slaughtering your name too badly.
No, you did a great job with it. Thanks for having the conversation. I really, really appreciate it, especially the callers who've had really great commentary. And I just want to add, I do racial justice work in the state with youth, and I think it's really important that we have a current normative sort of lens and presentism as we look at historical figures and our history. As you know, just like today, there are among us folks who believe in a flat earth and polygenesis of our ethnicities and everything. You know, back in the day, there always have been people who understood liberatory politics and fought for them. There always were women who knew that they were equal to men. There always were enslaved people who knew that there was no natural, you know, that they should not be enslaved and they're fighting for their freedom. You know, Denmark Vesey, John Brown, Harriet Tubman, you name it. And if we don't look through this lens, we have a really hard time holding ourselves to account today because we're really making excuses to the youth when we don't do that. And so, as you know, mentioning Thomas Jefferson, I think it's really important looking at, he knew that he was a hypocrite. You know, he in his writing had gone to his grave sort of standing by the fact that he didn't believe that African peoples were capable of thought beyond simple sentences. And yet he paid extra money for human beings who had greater levels of skill. He was enabled in his riches and his life by owning or thinking that he owned and profiting off of the lives of 600 enslaved people over the course of his life. You know, he's someone who personally paid to have people trained as the best chefs, the best mechanics, the best, you know, he knew that he was wrong. He was a 44-year-old man who sexually predated on a 14-year-old child, and that happened, and they knew, and it was wrong at the time,
yeah.
And there were excuses made because there were profits to be made
from it,
and I think it's important for us. Thank you.
It's a great point, Ndahe. Jeffrey, are we fooling ourselves when we think that people that were doing these things in the past were totally ignorant to how morally reprehensible a lot of people would later find it to be?
Well, again, let's bring it into the present and ask ourselves, have we corrected for all those evils? I mean, we have child slavery operating in this country. We have any number of abuses. If we put it in the larger context of how and why these things happen, we recognize that it has to do with the abuse of power. Ever present in human nature, and we need to be vigilant and careful in recognizing that when you allow people extraordinary power, more likely than not, they're going to abuse it. So, I think the conversation from my perspective, which is important, is inclusivity. I mean, one of the features of Vermont history that we're trying to correct for is, you know, we have this bucolic image of Vermont farmers, and yet the strength and vitality of Vermont, beginning in the 1840s with the arrival of the Irish and the trains, subsequently with the Italians and the granite and marble industry, and then subsequently with any number of Eastern Europeans, is that our immigrant populations have largely been an integral part of our strength and prosperity. So, you know, again, we need to look at history from the vantage point that we haven't gotten it right yet. We still need to do it.
Jeffrey, your comments are reminding me of a post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page that Michael left for us. He said, we should always remember that it can be dangerous to impose our own cultural context on another time and place. And he says he's often wondered about the following. We look back on previous cultures and judge their practices and conventions and find them, quote, wrong by our current standards and understanding of right and wrong. But I can't help but wonder what behaviors that we practice and consider honorable and justifiable will future societies condemn as unacceptable when judged by their then current standards. Kenneth, where are our blind spots right now, and what will people be looking back on 50, 100 years from now and saying, wow, I cannot believe that that sort of behavior was abided in 2017?
That's a good question and a tough one. I guess the most obvious one would be the one that jumped off the newspaper headlines yesterday, the question of transgender. I catch myself as I say that because of the speed with which this issue moved from invisible to very visible, just as gay rights and same-sex marriage moved with incredible rapidity in a short space of time from the turn of the 20th century into the 21st century, from a time when you had two presidential candidates who would have opposed it to complete acceptance of same-sex marriage. I wonder if 50 years from now people will look back and say, what do you mean they looked back, they dealt with transgendered people a different way? I would guess that might be the one because of the speed with which that is changing. And just a reminder that it was only 50 years ago that the Loving case was decided that allowed intermarriage in America as a national standard and struck down the miscegenation laws that existed. Only 50 years ago, it was still legal for a state to say that there could not be intermarriage. So the speed with that changed and same-sex marriage, I think, are indications that it's the sexual part of our wonderings that will be most bemusing in the future.
Jeffrey Potash is a longtime Vermont historian and co-author of Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont. Kenneth Davis is a historian and author of the Don't Know Much About series of books. I want to thank you both for being part of this discussion today. It was really great.
Great. Thank you.